Please be seated. The third case for oral argument this morning is, I guess both sides are appealing. One action, Stablers are appealing, and the Bank of Roscoe is the appellee. And on the other action, the Bank of Roscoe is the appellant, and the Stablers are the appellees. And we thought, to be fair to both sides, each one of you will get a 20-minute opening statement, and then each side will get a 10-minute rebuttal. So, obviously, the last, Mr. Schoenbeck will go first, and then I understand you gentlemen will be splitting your time. Is that correct?
That's correct, and I'll take the 20-minute segment, and Mr. Moore will take the
10. Okay, well, then during the 10-minute rebuttal, you only get to rebut. You can't bring up new things. So, any questions on the format? If not, we'd like to also acknowledge that Justice Wilbur has disqualified herself, and we're very pleased to welcome back an old friend and colleague, Justice Judith Meyer Henry, a former member of this court, has been appointed to sit in Justice Wilbur's behalf. With that, Mr. Schoenbeck, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes.
Justices, counsel, clerks, it's an honor every time I get to appear before you. This is an important case. In this case, both Judge Myron and a McPherson County jury found that the bank and the bank president committed fraud upon Stan and Rosemarie Stabler. There has to be an effective remedy to deter that type of conduct, and that's what our appeal is in large part about. They're also here, besides the two appeals, there's consolidated cases with many similar facts. Brad and Brenda Stabler, the children, or Brad's the son, their issues with Brad and Brenda and their issues with Stan and Rose. 40%.
Just a minute, I want to stop right here. In order to make it flow better, you can use your time to comment either on your appeal or their appeal, and the same privilege is granted to you. I'm not going to hold you to your appellant's 20 minutes. So,
thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
40% of our brief is devoted to the facts with copious references to the record because this is intensely factual. 7 years I've been working on peeling this onion. And so that's why so much of the brief is on the facts. If I could dive right into our brief and the issues, the very first issue involves Brad and Brenda, and I will tell you that this is easily, I think, for those of us that don't practice in the bankruptcy world, which is most of us attorneys in South Dakota, the most technical issue. And what happened here is a little bit of a sleight of hand under what's called 11 U.S.C. 524 A and C. A, we all know, that's the law that says you can't go chasing bankruptcy debt after a discharge. C, most of us never deal with, it's for reaffirmation agreements, and C only applies to a holder of a claim. So with that background, if I can walk through, the trial court found, this has to do with the Ipswich State Bank debt that John Byers took out of First State Bank of Roscoe, put it at Ipswich State Bank, and then later, and personally guaranteed it, and then later took the debt from the bank, Ipswich State Bank, when they couldn't collect on it or when they were apprised that there were issues with it. This is called the ISB debt, Ipswich State Bank. The trial court found that part of the ISB debt had been discharged in bankruptcy. The trial court concluded, though, and also found that John Byers knew of the bankruptcy and actually participated in the trial court's word in the scheme to create this. The trial court, though, said that Ipswich State Bank, they were innocent, and John Byers stood in their shoes. And so we weren't allowed to assert the defenses of illegality, fraud, and discharge against Ipswich, or against John Byers, because he was the assignee of Ipswich State Bank. Counsel effectively argued to the trial court that the 524 only applies to holders of a claim. That's true for 524C. Reaffirmation agreements apply to holders of claims. That is not true for 524A. The holder in due course laws in our state say that if you know about fraud, illegality, discharge, and you take an assignment of a debt, you take it subject to that knowledge. You're not a holder in due course. We briefed it. I won't repeat all the sites for you at length. In our brief, we went through the Uniform Commercial Code, the commentaries to it, There isn't any question that John Byers is not a holder in due course. The trial court felt constrained and said that the trial court felt that because Ipswich State Bank was innocent and he took from them, that we couldn't assert defenses. In reality, and it's interesting, the case that the bank cites, or buyer cites, U.S. Bank, when this court looks at that case, you'll see that here, where the court's already found that the debt was discharged, under U.S. Bank, the burden shifts. Under the U.S. Bank case, it was then their burden to show that it was not discharged debt or that they didn't know they were violating 524A, not C. I think the trial court was distracted by the arguments that interchange holder of a claim with holder in due course, and they're different concepts. And here, the law that we all know, that if you know that debt's been discharged and you take it, you're subject to that defense. We were not allowed that defense against that. So we would ask the court on our first issue with respect to the ISB debt to send it back for the trial court to reform the judgment. The trial court's made all the findings already that it was discharged debt, and Mr. Byers knew about it, in fact, designed the scheme himself. The second issue that we've raised is emotional distress. This is the second time I've been able to argue this issue before this court, because in Fix versus same bank, First State Bank of Roscoe, this court said that in an intentional tort setting, you could have the damages of emotional distress. That was one type of intentional tort. I thought the court painted the brush brought with a brush broad enough to say intentional torts, because that's what that body of law that led to the fixed decision was about. The trial court said there's no South Dakota Supreme Court cases that have ever addressed fraud with respect to emotional distress damages, and it's right in the trial court's in the transcript. He said, I'm not going to rule that way until the Supreme Court decides that that's the law. There are two bodies of law out there. And in fact, there's a Tolliver case from Nebraska cited by the bank. If you look at footnote 20, it takes you right to the ALR, and it tells you two bodies of law. One body of law are those states that have the exact same statute that we have, 2131, and say that any damages that flow from your conduct, you're responsible for. The other body of law are those states that say fraud typically arises in a commercial transaction, and so we're not going to allow emotional distress. I would say two things. First, you read that fact setting, this is not a typical commercial transaction. This was a very concerted effort to defraud people out of their land.
I have a question about that. Then we have some cases that say you do have to select whether you're pursuing as a plaintiff the tort action of fraud or deceit, or If you're pursuing fraudulent inducement of the contract, then you've got a contract claim. And I'm confused reading some of the instructions and so forth, exactly what you were pursuing. Were you pursuing the tort claim or the claim that was more on the fraudulent inducement and trying to rescind the contract?
Excellent.
Because I think
yes.
You talk out of both sides of your mouth a little bit in your brief. So
I agree with
you. Clear that up.
First, let me agree with you that I talked out of both sides of my mouth. And you cut me off before I got to, but when you get to issue 3, I'm wrong, and I'm not going to argue that before the court. That's the side of my mouth that was wrong. But to answer...
Wait a minute. Issue 3. Tell me what you're talking about. There's 25 issues, so...
Yeah, I agree. Issue number 3 in our brief is the one where I say, look, the jury found that there was fraud and inducement, so you ought to just wipe the whole note out. That's really, I think that's an incorrect legal argument. I thought about it. I said, back, that's not right. The part that should be gone is the part that where they found fraud. So that, at least in part, answers your question. But I think your question goes deeper than that, Justice. And the law is a little bit unusual in this. But in Granite City Motors, you just last week addressed the issue where somebody wants to, if you want to pursue fraud and seek damages, that you could do that as opposed to equitable relief. The inconsistency in my brief is issue 3, and I'm telling you right now that I'm wrong. Here we sought damages, and this court has to address, I don't think there's any confusion if this court says, you know what, in South Dakota, you can pursue emotional distress damages in an intentional tort act. Then everybody would say, okay, they were saying fraud, conspiracy, those are intentional torts. They should, which is the position we took through this whole case. They committed fraud upon us. We think that there are the damages of, we knew we could show the $439,100 of debt we didn't know that they were fraudulently pursuing. I think that's a damage. It certainly is an economic reality. It's a harm under anybody's world. Interestingly, as you've seen from our briefs, no cases that talk about when you have a finding of debt that somebody's asserting against you, is that a damage? It's certainly not in the traditional sense, but certainly in every other sense of harm that we talk about in cases. So I'm pursuing a damage claim. I hope this court is going to say, because both the judge and the jury found fraud, that they send it back, that you'll send it back so I can try my damages.
There are two instructions. One that was given, and I can't remember the name, the number of it. One was given as a fraudulent inducement and the elements of the fraudulent inducement. Then there was a misrepresentation. There was one that was more fraudulent misrepresentation. One is a tort, it looks to me like. One's a contract action. Both were presented to the jury. I think that's the confusing part for me.
Well, I'm going to apologize, but that wasn't appealed by either side.
Well,
so I didn't.
It does go to whether you get an emotional distress or punitive damages and or punitive damages.
My apologies that I haven't went back and reread those instructions with the 25 arguments I was getting ready for. But
had you selected and made it clear to the court that what you were pursuing was the tort action and not the fraudulent inducement of the contract?
Yes. The court did what you're doing, put it to us point blank at the pretrial and said, you got to pick. And we said, we're going after the fraud and the tort damages.
But in instruction 12, the jury was only instructed to consider whether Stan and Rose, and this is skipping to the other case, but was instructed to determine only whether they're entitled to avoid paying the defendants. That's rescission. That's equitable. That's not a damage claim.
Well, two things. First, that's because the judge then dismissed my emotional distress damage claim, and so that part of the question, what this court does with emotional distress damages in this case, it becomes an obvious it answers itself if you say you should have been allowed to pursue emotional distress damages. We would all recognize that as a tort. The other part of that is whether or not this court decides, what no court has been called upon to decide based upon the briefs of either party in our research, whether a finding of $439,100 of fraudulently obtained debt is in fact a damage. And that's an issue.
But the jury wasn't instructed on damages to that point.
They were asked to decide if they thought any part
right.
of the note was the product of fraud. That was the damage instruction that they had. And again, it wasn't raised on appeal, so I didn't. I'm going to apologize for not having went back and reread that instruction.
Right. Well, you touched on another thing. We're jumping around here a little bit, but you were talking about the $439,000 and whether or not that is damages, and Judge Myron referred to the Hoas case, which was against him and coincidentally was written by Justice Meyer Henry, where it dealt with a set-off and whether or not there is damage when there is a set-off. Isn't that critical to the issue of punitive damages? How we decide that, and how is this case distinguishable from Hoas?
Let me first say that I think the court referenced that in the jury found punitive damages of $20,000, and the judge tossed it based on Hoas.
Right.
You think with 25 issues, you guys would find plenty enough to ask questions about without the ones that weren't brief. But that's a great question, and we did at the trial level discuss it. But I'm trying to remember. I can tell you in Hoas there wasn't a specific finding of damages like there was in this case. This jury was actually asked to make a finding. So that didn't happen in Hoas. Beyond that, I'm going to apologize, Your Honor.
All right.
On the punitive damage issue, the issue four in our brief, that's going to come down to what this court decides on emotional distress damages in an intentional tort and whether or not this court decides that a finding by a jury of $439,100 of fraud is the kind of harm that would support a claim for punitive damages, and that's squarely in this court's. Issue number five, the bankruptcy fee, I'd ask you, the court, look at the contract. The contract, which is...
All right, before you go there,
thank you.
Didn't you stipulate to that?
We stipulated we'd pay all the attorney's fees that were required under the contract. I mean, we agreed that under the contract they were entitled to attorney's fees. We agreed to that. Nobody was talking about any attorney's fees outside the contract because, of course, that wouldn't be a logical discussion in South Dakota with our body of law. But it clearly was we have to pay every penny required under the contract. Under the contract, though, to get bankruptcy fees, the contract specifically says that it has to be to the extent permitted by the bankruptcy code when they're exercising authority under their bankruptcy jurisdiction. Well, so they submitted bankruptcy attorney's fees of over $35,000. They didn't go to the bankruptcy court. They came to the state trial court and said, give us those fees for that other proceeding. And you'll look in the briefs. They're not telling you there's any place under the bankruptcy code where they're entitled to them because they're not. And, Justice, you have a great question because when I read it, where's this come from? But Judge Myron said, fees were agreed to, so I'm awarding fees. But fees were agreed to because the contract says they're entitled to fees. And they should get every penny of fees authorized by the contract and none that the contract doesn't authorize. The last issue in our part of it, and then I'll, to the extent allowed, I'll charge into some of the others. Issue number six, the 2009 addendum for the 2004 CREM, let's say CREM, collateral real estate mortgage. I would ask the court to look at SDCL 44-8-29-2. That's the statute that says that when you assign a mortgage, now the assignee is the person who has the rights of the mortgage holder. What happened here, the mortgage had been assigned to John Byers. He was the one that had all the rights of the mortgage holder, and he did not sign the CREM.
All right. Which is the law requires. That, my question is that that goes to the enforceability of the mortgage, but now there's a judgment, isn't there? So isn't it moot? Because there's a judgment anything that's left in the debt is a judgment debt. He's not foreclosing on the mortgage at this point.
Well, it does affect whether or not what collateral exists to support the judgment. I mean, at this point, in fact, he did get a judgment to foreclose on a mortgage that was not properly extended as part of the judgment in this. So it's not a moot issue today.
Okay.
Then if I might, Justices, I'd like to go to their article, Roman numeral 2, their topics, and I'll charge through it if time allows. You know, they allege that, I want to point out there that there's like 9 issues there, and all of those are supposed to be reasons for a new trial, 7 of which supposedly happened at trial. And some of those, like the last one, where there is not something that happened at trial, it was a summary judgment that they were denied, and now they're asking it to be reversed on the grounds of conduct at trial, errors of law at trial, so it's not a proper... It's not properly appealed before this court. But their first one is the hold views and testimony. It's an abuse of discretion standard. Judge Myron heard all the evidence. Tom Holdhusen's testimony was valid or admissible for a lot of reasons. They've pulled out one reason and said that they think that was wrong and it's an abuse of discretion. I believe Judge Myron was right, and the record supports it factually. The authority they have is an Arkansas trial judge 20 years ago who found an expert who on the hold use and testimony, Judge Myron was right. His testimony is admissible for a lot of reasons, and the one sentence that they think he lied on, that we don't think he lied on, is a small part of the testimony.
Mr. Schoenberg, I want to skip to an issue because we're going to run out of time. I'm having a lot of difficulty understanding how you can affirm, this is with respect to Stan and Rose's case, how you can essentially affirm the 2004 CREM to avoid the judgment, to avoid the counterclaim judgments on the 2000 and the 2002 securities that were, encumbrances that were given. It seems to me, I mean, it's a real problem for me because yes, in 2004, maybe they got defrauded. That was after the bankruptcy. But I don't understand why those 2000 and 2002 how you can pursue both at the same time, how you can prevail on both at the same time.
Thank you. I think you're talking about issue B or the second one and their appeal, where they keep saying, well, they use this as a sword and now they're using it as a shield, and they accuse us of taking inconsistent positions with respect to those earlier mortgages. If you look at Judge Myron's decision, there are two things we raised, neither of which were claiming that the 2004 mortgage was valid. But they keep repeating that, and they've repeated it so many times that finally I started in documents I was filing after that decision came down. You'll find it on page 22 in our appellee index. I started filing documents and said, wait a minute, that's not true. We never argued the 2004 mortgage was valid at any point in that summary judgment proceeding. Here's what happened. Three things happened. Two of them we initiated. One of them, we said, is with respect to the CREM, to properly renew a CREM, you have to do it within a certain time period, and they didn't do it.
I understand.
Okay,
that.
So that's not saying the 2004 mortgage is valid.
Right.
The second thing we said is, at some point, they assigned mortgages but not notes. And we said, as a matter of law, the law is clear in South Dakota, you can't take a mortgage without a note. You got to have the note. And they'd already given the note to somebody else. So this mortgage, these later mortgage assignments couldn't be valid because no note with them. We did in any respect say the 2004 note and mortgage valid. We always contended it wasn't. But the third thing that happened, and this is, which was not appealed, by the way, by the bank, is that Judge Myron, which it goes to that issue about the assignment of the mortgage without the note. They didn't appeal that. It's not before you. But here's what happened. Judge Myron, on his own, and you saw in his trial, he referred to it as maddening, defies logic, that it took him several weeks. He went through all of those very documents, and he said, look, here's what really happened. This is this, and that goes to what you're saying, Justice. It's not even a motion we made. He went through and tried to make sense of all the documents so he could decide the case. And in that, he said, this is what's really left here. And that was not appealed by the bank at any point.
Your time has expired. Thank you. Okay. Counsel, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You proceed, Mr. Damgarden.
Good morning. Roger Damgarden, Sandra Moorhead, from the Roscoe Bank, and John Byers. It's pretty easy to kind of drift away from what's really important here. And I think that we take a hard look at the fact that the bank filed a motion for summary judgment on Stan Rosemarie's Count 3 fraud claim. And we ask that our summary judgment be granted and the Count 3 claim be dismissed because there wasn't any fraud. And interestingly enough, fraud, of course, is a tort. And my understanding is it's a tort, and it was pled in this case. And every tort has elements. And so no matter how much we talk about the smoke screens and all these factual allegations, we need to pull ourselves back into some guidance from what these elements are. And in this case, what's relevant is, was there a knowing misrepresentation of fact? That's really the issue, I think, that's pivotal in this case. And not law, but facts.
Well, you know, Judge Myron's opinion after the court trial, after he heard all the evidence, he lays out a pretty compelling case for factual fraud in his memorandum.
I disagree, and I think when I'm able to further my argument, I think you'll see where I'm going, where I'm coming from.
Well, you're going to go to the thing about the reaffirmation issue, the legal question.
Yes, that's the allegation of fraud.
Right, and I understand that, but he talks about a lot of facts. Judge Myron does in his memorandum opinion after the court trial.
Well, Judge Myron wasn't the finder of fact at the jury trial, only at the court trial. And the court trial was about Brad and Brenda. It wasn't about Stan and Rose.
But I guess my point is he just repeats a lot of things that he saw at the court trial that tend to suggest a factual issue on fraud.
I think what happened to Judge Myron, in all due respect, is that he was correct when he dismissed fiduciary duty claim in this case. And then he was angry with Mr. Byers because he said, well, John Byers is not out here acting to help out the Stablers. He's out here acting on his own behalf. Well, having just dismissed the breach of fiduciary duty claim, of course that's what he was doing. Ordinarily in a debtor-creditor relationship, there is no fiduciary duty. And so what what Byers was doing was acting in his own interest, which was what he should be doing, what was okay.
All right. Well, let's – and I've read your legal arguments, so you don't need to repeat that totally for us. But factually, on the consideration for the reaffirmation, was there any new consideration other than the not foreclosure?
The forbearance?
Right.
Yeah, well, forbearance was a big package, and it was. In addition to the forbearance, Byers promised that he would continue to be their banker to the best that he could. And I think there was testimony from Mr. Nash and other people in the case, and just practically speaking, we all know that every farmer out there needs a banker. It's tough being a farmer or a business person without a banker. He promised he would be their banker, and the record shows he loaned them hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Well, at the point of the bankruptcy, I think it was $261,000 was what was on the schedules or whatever. I don't know exactly, but was there any type of appraisal when they added the 2004 CREM that tied it to some kind of value? Because that was for $650,000. What was that in relation to what the debt was?
Okay. Well, you know, I think we have to realize is that the consideration was actually quite broad. It wasn't. There was the fact that there was a lot of cross collateralization and cross default. So what was going on is that we had a $200,000 mortgage that Stan and Rose had on their four generation home place that was in play,
which was paid down to
about $110,000.
Right,
definitely in play. But at this time, Stan admitted that he was in default to the bank on his obligations to the bank, and that the bank could have foreclosed. And if the bank would have foreclosed, he would never have been able to take advantage of the substantial increases in land prices that had occurred. And so what we have here is a situation where we have a ton of consideration. And the consideration is not only the forbearance as to Brad, but the forbearance as to Stan.
But was there any valuation of what the forbearance on the mortgages relating to the $650,000 mortgage?
What's it worth to be out of business as a farmer and not be able to function as a farmer? What's it worth to not have a banker to help you out in your particular situation? What's it worth to be out of business and not be able to take advantage of increasing land prices that ultimately make you a multimillionaire? So I think there's very substantial consideration. You have to consider it, the whole pool of the consideration that was available. Now, I want to get back. I think it's really important to look at what was supposedly supposed to be the fraud in this case. Well, the judge took after Mr. Schoenberg pretty hard at the pretrial and got him to agree what the fraud was. And we take a look at that. We take a look at what was raised in the summary judgment argument. And what it all boils down to this is the fraud was that allegedly Mr. Byers said, listen, Brad owes this debt, when in fact Brad did owe that debt because it had been discharged in bankruptcy and it hadn't been reaffirmed. It really boils down to that, the fact that the debt, they told us that Brad owed this debt when Brad didn't owe this debt. Whether Brad owed the debt or didn't owe the debt, depending on which of two lines of cases would ultimately be the law in South Dakota. You know, one is the forbearance line of cases, where you agree to forbear, and that's the consideration. And you agree to forbear and not foreclose. And we know that's a split of authority. We know that there are cases that go that way that find that to be adequate consideration, find that to be a binding situation, that if you do that, enter into those new documents, you're bound. And then we have another line of cases which say, no, you have to do an official reaffirmation agreement, and that's the only way you can do it. So really what it comes down to, whether or not Brad owed the money, depended on which of those two lines of cases that Judge Myron found to be persuasive.
What about the sequencing, though? Is that even material? Because the question is, did he owe the debt before he reaffirmed? And he did not at that point. In other words, when Byers was doing this and making these statements that Brad owned the debt, at that point, there had been no reaffirmation, right?
There never was a reaffirmation.
Well, excuse me. They hadn't executed the 2004 CRAM and all that. That's what he said in order to get them to execute the 2004 CRAM.
That's the allegation,
that
yes.
That Brad owed the debt.
Yes.
And there had been no, at that point, there had been no attempt to, I mean, reaffirmation wasn't even at issue at that point. But the reaffirmation would have been of the 2004 CRAM. That's what you would have had to go to the bankruptcy court with, wouldn't it be?
The document was executed simultaneously by Brad and his parents at the same time. And the deal was made before that. The agreement was made before that. The new documents were actually executed after that. Brad's testimony is pretty compelling about what the agreement was. I mean, but we agreed to. I agreed that I would pay you back. You agreed that you wouldn't foreclose on me. You agreed you'd continue to be my banker. And that's, I don't think that's unrefuted. So when I sat down there and signed those documents, at that time, those documents just reinforced the agreement that Brad had made earlier.
Well, one other part of that, and is the $100,000, there was a representation, or there's an allegation of a representation that $550,000 of the $650,000 was Brad and Brenda's, and $100,000 was Stan and Rose. Isn't that also part of the misrepresentation?
Well, it's not a theory of fraud that the court let go to the jury. The court made it very clear, and there's an order that the court entered, said, here's what the fraud is in this case. And I was told that if I signed this note, that I was only responsible for $100,000, not $550,000 of it. That was a new issue of fraud that was not what the judge ordered that the plaintiffs had limited themselves to. Ask yourself this. We have spent 5 years dealing with all these esoteric bankruptcy issues, and all of a sudden Stan Stabler blurts out, you know, on a cross-examination by me on a totally different topic that I was told by John Byers I only had to pay $100,000 back and the other $550,000 I wouldn't have to worry about.
Yeah, but that it wasn't totally new there. It was part of the discovery and the motions before.
Your Honor, there's an order on our basis for our motion in limine. It says this is what the fraud is. And believe me, the fraud wasn't the $550,000 allegation. And there's just...
Was that the order on summary judgment?
Excuse me?
Was that the order?
No, based on... It was a pretrial, Your Honor. It was a motion in limine on a pretrial to limit what... To identify what the fraud was and then to limit the jury's consideration to what the fraud was.
Let's just go beyond the summary judgment, just assuming that we uphold the trial court on going to a jury. Was this tried as a tort or as a contract action?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, your earlier statements led me to believe that you were all trying a tort action. In which case, then my question would be: why shouldn't emotional distress have been one of the elements, and why shouldn't the punitive damages stand? If it's tort, those two things would go with tort. If it was fraudulent inducement for contract, then maybe not. So my question, I guess, is what were you people trying? Were you trying a tort action or contract and rescission of the contract?
What we were really trying, ultimately, was a rescission of the contract, an equitable action. Because what happened was, and there was an instruction that was given to the jury before the case started. Of course, there were instructions afterwards. And the issue was phrased as to what part of the mortgage was procured by fraud. And to the extent it was procured by fraud, then they had no obligation to pay that. Clearly rescission. And as Justin Konenkamp pointed out in the Lumber case, that, you know, the bottom line is if you elect rescission, and it's certainly tried rescission, you waive your damages, including your tort damages.
Well,
I believe that's what happened.
Can you split a rescission? I mean, if you rescind a contract, you rescind the contract, how would there be anything of the $650,000, and the jury found that they owed the difference between $650,000 and $469,000, whatever the number is.
It was actually more of a reformation, wasn't it, as as, I mean, what the jury did is they reformed the contract as opposed to rescinding the whole thing.
The jury was asked to, in essence, void the contract to the extent it was procured by fraud and say it's not enforceable, recognizing that, you know, that the particular amount that was owed, some may be procured by fraud, some wasn't.
That isn't the wording of the jury instruction, though, is it? You're saying that's the effect of it.
I don't have it in front of me right now, but if you look at the instructions that were given, I think in the opening instruction and then the instruction was given at the close of the evidence, I think both of those are pretty clear that to the extent that the mortgage and note was procured by fraud, that you may find all or part of it was procured by fraud, and to the extent you find it was procured by fraud, then and under those circumstances, you'd be relieved from any obligation to have to live up to the contract.
That is what jury instruction 12 says. But my question is, at that point, Mr. Schoenbeck's case, he's limited in what he can take to the jury because of the rulings on emotional distress were made before the trial.
Yes, they were.
And so he has nothing else to go to the jury with other than what appears to be a request for a rescission.
I think he didn't have any damages. There's no doubt that he didn't have any damages, either because he withdrew all of them or the court ruled against him in the case of the emotional distress damages.
That's true. So we kind of have a chicken and egg. Which issue do we decide first? Quick question here.
Well, there was no fraud here. There wasn't any fraud because what happened is that Judge Myron had a decision to make on which of these two lines of cases he was going to follow. He chose the reaffirmation line that said you had to have an official reaffirmation agreement and you couldn't do it any other way. And that meant that Brad Stabler didn't owe the money. If he would have gone to the forbearance line, Brad Stabler would owe the money. Now, how can that be a knowing misrepresentation of fact? It's not even knowing misrepresentation of the law. How could John Byers, with a high school education, a small-town banker, know in 2004 what Judge Myron was going to rule 5 years later? Of course, he couldn't. And so that summary judgment should have been granted. Now, I want to briefly address the estoppel issue that we raised. We raise that as a partial summary judgment. In spite of what Mr. Schoenbeck says, I believe the record will show that the 2004 note and mortgage for $650,000, that is a successor document to those earlier mortgages and earlier notes. And Judge Myron ruled that, listen, you, Mr. Schoenbeck, has made a motion for summary judgment to dismiss counts, I believe 5 and 6 of the counterclaims, saying they should go away because they've been released and satisfied by the newer notes and mortgages. Well, clearly you couldn't release and satisfy those counterclaim obligations and notes unless the new obligation was valid and enforceable. Makes sense. So he uses that to get what he wants, to get rid of the counterclaims. And then he turns around and says to the judge, let him do it, I'm going to then switch gears and say, I'm going to attack this mortgage. This mortgage isn't valid. It isn't enforceable. It was procured by fraud, and I should be able to attack this mortgage and end up being in a situation where the mortgage ends up where it has no value and they don't owe a dime on it. That situation.
Mr. Schoenbeck told us in an argument just a moment ago, though, that he was attacking the 2004 mortgages on a different for a different reason, not fraud.
I disagree with that.
Okay.
And so the point being, on one hand, he's over here saying this mortgage is valid and enforceable to take care of this. Then on the other hand, he's saying, well, you know, I really want to attack this mortgage now. I want to attack this mortgage because it's not valid, it's not enforceable. Of course, he had a little problem by then. He didn't have any damages, so he probably had to go with the rescission. But, you know, the integrity of the system would suggest you can't have both ends and make them work towards the middle. And that's exactly what was going on and exactly what was happening with regard to that situation. You can't use the mortgage to get rid of counterclaims and say it's valid and then turn around and tack and say it's invalid over here. It's just too cute.
But adding the numbers, didn't the jury, in fact, leave the amount of the 2002 CREM and the operating loan? They didn't dismiss that, that wasn't part of the $461,000, at least if you add the numbers together, was it?
No, but we didn't know what was going to happen. And we don't know what juries are going to do. The jury was instructed that they could invalidate in whole or in part. And, you know,
they happened to come out to the dollar of doing that.
But that doesn't take away the inconsistent positions. And also, you want to remember that, you know, there was probably more value, in my opinion, there with regard to the CRIM than...
Which CRIM?
Collateral real estate mortgage. There's probably more...
I know. There's two of them.
I'm talking about the counterclaim one, the 2002 one. I think there was an operating line, just advances that have been made there. And I think even if you throw away the collateral real estate mortgage, you still have indebtedness there. And as you pointed out, all we have had to do is to exercise... that indebtedness, get a judgment on, foreclose on that. There's plenty of collateral for us to do that. So the point is that we were in a situation where if the jury had gone differently, we could have ended up in a situation where we would have money that was not procured by fraud under any circumstances. We would not be able to get back again. And I think to an extent that happened under this situation.
So let me ask you just one question on the summary judgment. Are you saying if the judge was wrong on granting the summary judgment, the original one that you were talking about, does this domino effect on the whole case, on both cases?
What it does is that it means that their count three fraud claim has to be dismissed.
Well, that's
because it doesn't meet the elements. So the count three fraud claim goes...
What's left then?
I don't think there's anything left to the case. No, that's it.
But to follow up on that, don't you have to really attack the evidence at trial rather than the summary judgment? Because even if the trial court made an error in denying you summary judgment, it still went to a fact finder, and a fact finder obviously found there was a question of fact against you.
Well,
so I mean, I know you're arguing summary judgment. But what difference does it make since it actually went to a fact finder and the fact finder found against you?
Because the fact finders find situations where there's genuine issues of material fact. There are no genuine issues of material fact. The summary judgment should have been granted. It made sense that it should be granted. It's clear that it should be granted. And the fact that it went to the jury, so the jury is considering, the jury was considering facts in a case where there was no genuine issue of material fact. They might have thought they were material, but they weren't. We should have gotten our summary judgment. It should have never gone to the jury.
Thank you, Mr. Damgar. Your time has expired. Mr. Schoenbeck, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Justices. And I'm working on the assumption the only thing I am to rebut is our issues that they've raised.
Yeah. I think that's the purpose of rebuttal. It's fairest because I'm holding them to that standard.
Thank you. If I can first, it's Appellee's app. Page 22, because they kept saying that we allege that 2004 mortgage is a sword and we're now using it as a shield or vice versa, other way, I started putting in pleadings before the trial court. We never did that. And this is we're saying right there that the argument they're making, we're telling the trial courts, we've never argued that 2004 mortgage is valid in any venue.
Well, how did you prevail on the counterclaims then?
There was three things the judge did. One of them was because the CREM was not renewed in the appropriate time. It doesn't matter about the two. They just didn't meet the statute requirements. And the other one, which is what our other motion we made, was because they assigned mortgage without debt. And the law in South Dakota is you can't do that. The mortgage is invalid unless you have the note. And that's all we did.
But we
were very particular not to do more because we always contended that mortgage wasn't valid.
If the 2002... CREM, the mortgage part of it wasn't renewed. The note, that doesn't mean the money goes away or the note goes away. That's what got rolled into the $650,000.
That's correct. In fact, that's why this issue, first, there is no such thing to judicially stop, but you're right with your earlier comments, Justice, when you said, well, this didn't really change anything. The jury had it all in front of them. In fact, in their brief, they're not claiming there's any debt that they didn't get to pursue that was valid debt.
The only debt they didn't get to pursue, they got to pursue it all. The jury said $439,100 of that was fraud. There were some other things you raised, if I might. The answer to whether or not there's an appraisal is no. There was never an appraisal. The answer about whether there was consideration is that 524C on reaffirmations is not a self-help remedy. There are a whole pile of criteria you're supposed to go back so that you can make sure that they have the ability to pay and a whole host of things. None of it was followed. Here's a point Justice Meyer and Judge Meyer, excuse me, made with respect to that issue that Mr. Damgaard's been arguing that this was a mistake of law. And it's in our brief. John Byers said, Rob Ronan told me we didn't need a reaffirmation agreement. Under oath, Rob Ronan at the trial said, I never said that. And Judge Myron, when faced with that issue, he said, there's a question of fact here. See, you have to peel back even before the 2002 decision in Du Bois, which I think was settled law, the minority arguments they've been making, that they say split of authority. The facts were that John Byers, it appears, made the whole story up at the time. He's now saying, I was told that that was the law, and I followed it, and it was apparently a minority position. That's not true. He testified under oath, Rob Ronan told him that, and Rob Ronan said, I didn't do that. And Judge Myron, when he had this issue before him at the summary judgment or the pretrial motion stage, he said, there's a question of fact here that a jury ought to decide, which is whether there was, you can't just pull out the air and say, oh, there was a legal dispute back at the time, and I happened to pick that one minority side. He lied about whether he had any legal advice when he did it, and the jury heard that evidence. Justice Myron, I'm going to apologize, not just here, I'm going to apologize all the way home as I re-kick this argument around, but it is a bit confusing, but we tried a tort case. And we all understood it was a tort case. In the transcript, maybe a little bit in the brief, they screamed to high heaven about trying a tort case. They forced us to make an election, as they rightfully should, and we elected not rescission. And whatever you do, I think part turns on how you view the two damage issues. The finding of debt that was fraudulently obtained and emotional distress. But if you send it back, just so we're clear, it's going to go to the trial judge to decide whether or not there was fraud. And he said there was fraud, too. And the fraud was replete. It's not just, he lied about the whole thing about reaffirmation. But he lied about Brad owing the money. He lied about, there were some great questions about the pursuing the debt. The court can see in the factual summary, it reads like a novel. Grisham should make a movie out of this. He went for 2 years after the fact John Byers did, filling out Stan's financial statements saying he only owed $100,000 on the $650,000 note. That went on for 2 years. Just like Stan testified at trial, he said, I only owed $100,000. And that's how he did it. And then when there was a falling out, all of a sudden, oh no, $650,000. So the record, Judge Myron nailed it.
That related to the Ipswich Bank matter, not the the financial statements issue. That related to the Ipswich Bank, not the 2004 Crown.
That was at the first. You'll see in there for the First State Bank of Roscoe, and I think for Public Farm Credit or somebody, they had to do. Stan had to do annual financial statements. Byers filled them out for him after 2004, and in 2005 and 2006, well, one of them he did like a week after he got him to sign the mortgage, which, by the way, he got him to sign over $1 million worth of documents that day for debt that they mostly didn't know. And but about a week later, for his bank, he got him to sign a financial statement. He put it down at $100,000. And then a year later, and I can't remember if that was for Farm Credit or his bank, he had Stan do another financial statement, then he put it down at $100,000.
But that was all after the 2004 Crown.
Yes, yeah. I 25 pages, he didn't get through all his, because there's a whole lot of stuff I'd like to say about those. I'm not sure if the court wants me to argue the things that weren't argued, but they're briefed. And if there are things I would say about a few of them,
I think, in fairness, that even though he could rebut what you say, we got to have a level playing field here. So you can you're relying on your brief for everything else. You're not waiving anything.
Okay, thank you. Then let me say that what you have to have happen, the law makes sense. The law has to make sense. And I don't think people see judges as lawgivers, but you're lawmakers too. I mean, you are. And here there are some, you've got to sort out some positions that our state's never taken a position on, and quite frankly, you're lawgivers on those things. And there has to be an effective remedy for a bank and a banker that go out and in such a concerted way set out to cheat somebody. There has to be a remedy. And the confusion, Justice Murray and others who have raised it, is because somehow our law has got to have a way for the law to be a deterrent for this kind of conduct. And a rescission is not enough. A rescission where you catch a thief and he has to give back what he stole, that's not enough. There has to be a better remedy than that. And that's why I tried it as a tort claim. I always believed after 7 years and thousands of pages of documents, I could show how he ran his scam. You've got it in 22 pages of factual summary. But that's not enough. There's got to be, the jury's got to have the ability to do something. And the something is what this court set out in Fix. When you show an intentional act, a very real scam, not some imaginary thing. Judge Myron, he's from Campbell County. Nobody's ever acted crazy in Campbell County. I mean, he's as conservative as they come. I shouldn't say nobody's ever acted crazy in Campbell County, but he's a very conservative judge. He looked at those facts, and you saw his decision. There's got to be a way that the law provides a protection, and the way it does is if you cause distress to somebody, you ought to have to be held accountable in a fraud and conspiracy scheme, and the jury ought to have the ability, when they're making that decision, to award appropriate punitive damages. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Schoenbeck. Mr. Moorhead, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Justice.
Chief Justice, may it please the court, counsel, clerks. I want to try to stick to where Mr. Schoenbeck was and try to take it in the order. One of the questions that's been coming up a lot is, did we try a tort or did we try a rescission claim? The answer is Judge Myron gave us the answer. In our brief where we talk about the judicial estoppel issue, we pointed out that the bank and buyers brought a motion on judicial estoppel saying, look, they've claimed the benefits of the presumed validity of this note and transaction in order to get two of our earlier mortgages discharged and the counterclaims dismissed. So they can't assert that those are invalid anymore. They're limited to seeking damages. They've essentially done that election that's talked about in the election remedies cases. Or, looking at it from the other direction, they're judicially estopped to say now it's invalid. And Judge Myron said, and I asked him a couple of times on the record, and he very emphatically, and we've cited it in the transcript, we asked him, okay, he said, I'm going to grant the motion provisionally. He said, but I'm going to say it's granted, but they're still permitted to seek fraud in the procurement. They're still proceeded to go that way. He clearly made it, so the problem is they've gone ahead now and Judge Myron then let them go ahead and have a jury trial where they were able to seek the rescission that he said they couldn't have. And so the jury trial, when you look at, instruction 12 does talk about Standard Rose had approved the note mortgage were obtained through fraud and, quote, that Stan and Rose Stabler are entitled to avoid paying the defendants on some or all of the note and are entitled to avoid the effects of the mortgage in whole or in part. That is rescission. That's the definition of trying a rescission case, trying to avoid having to pay. That dovetails with this emotional distress argument that keeps coming up.
Before you go to that, though, what about saying that 439 or 79, whatever, thousandth, that was pecuniary, that was a pecuniary loss that was recovered?
Respectfully, Your Honor, if that's not rescission, I don't know what is. Avoiding, that's the depth, that would be, anytime somebody was able to avoid a contract and avoid paying under a contract, then it would suddenly become damages instead of rescission when that's not the case. It is rescission. They raised four different damages claims before trial, identified them in discovery. One was this emotional distress claim. One was payments made on debt that shouldn't have been procured. Of course, with Standard Rose, they didn't have any, so they waived that. Another one was an attorney's fee claim, which they also waived. And another was a, they called it like a damage to credit reputation claim, which they also waived. Once the court dismissed their emotional distress claim, all of their damages claims were gone. All they had left was a rescission claim. But as we pointed out in our brief, at that point, they should have been foreclosed from seeking rescission. Why? Because 4 years earlier in the case, in 2010, they brought a motion. Mr. Schoenbeck keeps saying that they didn't make this motion. We've gone ahead and we put their brief and we've cited to it. We've cited in the record to their brief and the arguments that they made, the arguments that were made at the hearing. They took the position that that $650,000 transaction and payments that were made under that transaction had the effect of discharging earlier debt. We've gone ahead and cited that. It's in our appendix. Once they took that position, they were foreclosed from seeking to rescind. Why? Because they had necessarily taken the position it was a valid debt and that it was enforceable by asserting that it had discharged earlier transactions. That occurred back in 2010.
Okay, well then the question is, did you object to Instruction 12?
Did we object to Instruction 12?
At the trial.
We didn't object to Instruction 12 because the judge had over our objection. At the pretrial hearing, we said we shouldn't be going forward. They shouldn't be permitted to do this. They shouldn't be permitted to try that. And then we cited to the portions of the record. You can see it where Judge Myron and I have a colloquy about the issue, and he says, well, I've always said that I'm going to let them go ahead and show fraud in the procurement. So he basically goes ahead and lets them have the rescission claim that they weren't entitled to have.
He also let the jury determine punitive damages.
He did.
So that almost supports the fact that you were trying a tort case.
Well, Your Honor, before we started the jury trial, and we've noted this as well, we brought a motion to Judge Myron's attention saying, look, with the way this case is going to be tried, where Standard Rose Stabler are simply trying to avoid paying some of this note, they're never going to get any compensatory damages. And because they're never going to get any compensatory damages under Henry versus Henry, they can't get any punitive damages. And we've explained why it was prejudicial for other reasons to allow that. But Judge Myron did finally, belatedly after the fact, after the trial, he realized and he agreed in his written decision, you know what, there weren't any compensatory damages here. And so he did vacate the punitive damages claim. Now, we're not waiving our claim that letting that punitive damages claim go to the jury was prejudicial for the reasons we've raised. And because of the arguments that the Stablers were allowed to make to the jury, they wouldn't have been able to make in a non-punitive damages case. But Judge Myron did at least properly get rid of that claim when he realized no damages had been allowed.
Well, if it's a rescission, how do you get to any different result than where you're at right now?
Pardon?
How do you get to a different result if there was a partial rescission with what the jury's damage award was, the $431,000 that they found was procured by fraud? If you have partial rescission, you get to the same place, don't you?
Well, but the point that we've made, Your Honor, is first of all, we don't think that there is any fraud in this case. And we think that for all the reasons that Mr. Damgaard talked about, this case shouldn't have gone to the jury on that. But okay, rescission shouldn't have been available either for the reasons we raised in our judicial estoppel motion. Once they took the position that the $650,000 note and mortgage were effective, viable, capable of discharging earlier debt, and that's what Judge Myron decided.
But that didn't discharge $650,000 worth of debt. It discharged an operating line of credit that varied up to $189,000, I think, and you kept in your brief saying $200,000, but it wasn't a $200,000 mortgage. It was paid down to $110,000.
But those aren't the
$189,000, and the note was for $650,000.
But those weren't the only debts that were secured by the two mortgages. You had the $2,000 mortgage, the original one on the home place. That was on a quarter of the real estate. The 2002
was paid down.
And that had been paid down. Absolutely. It was paid down to $110,000, I believe, $900.
Which you never mentioned in your brief, but go
ahead.
No,
it was paid down to one. Well, but we did get to that amount. The other part is, under the 2002 mortgage, there was more than just that operating line that was listed as debts that were secured by the 2002 mortgage. I believe the Stablers, in their own brief, have harped over and over again that there were hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt on that 2002 mortgage that they were upset about that was included. Now, they never submitted that issue to the jury, so they've waived any complaint about it or any allegation that was fraud, but the 2002 mortgage, the Stablers have even said.
That's the one where there was an issue of the second page missing that had $700,000 worth of notes.
Correct.
On a $200,000 mortgage.
Well, but collateral real estate mortgages can be used to support any amount of debt. It's just you only have a lien up to that certain amount.
But you didn't try that issue of whether or not that second page was or was not included.
No, we didn't, but that wasn't our claim. It was the plaintiff's claim. The plaintiffs had originally, earlier in the case, asserted that there was a missing page. But for some reason, the plaintiffs didn't submit that issue to the jury. Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't think it's the defendant's job to make sure that the plaintiffs are submitting the issue of the plaintiff's case to the jury. For whatever reason, the plaintiffs apparently didn't want to have the jury make a decision on that issue. And they didn't get a decision on that issue. With regard to the emotional distress issue and whether emotional distress damages are available, we keep hearing about no law. One of the cases we've cited repeatedly is Collins. It's 586 Southeast 2nd, 128, pinpoint 131. It's a South Carolina case from 2003. That's a case that specifically dealt with this, where somebody got a rescission on a promissory note, and the court there said, that's not damages. It won't support a punitive damages award. Getting part of a note canceled doesn't meet the definition of damages. Finally, Your Honors, heard a lot about cheating somebody and things like this. Ultimately, the Stabler's case here was that we should have foreclosed on them instead of letting them keep their property and continue. This case has gone through six briefs, hours of argument. We talk about Judge Myron. Judge Myron's decision doesn't contain a single misrepresentation. All he finds is, well, I find John Byers was acting in his own self-interest. Well, a bank, under South Dakota law for two decades now, it's black letter law, a bank's presumed to be acting in its own self-interest.
Thank you, Mr. Moorhead. Your time has expired. The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.